Chapter 2. The Mission. Of the many great military leaders in American history, Joshua L. Chamberlain was arguably one of the greatest. His actions, captured in print and in the motion picture film Gettysburg, should be studied. The following vignette references the early July 1863 Civil War battle at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Highlighted are some of the tenets of command that still apply today. Lessons of Leadership in Action. In late June 1863, General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia passed through Maryland and invaded Pennsylvania. For 5 days, the Army of the Potomac hurried to get between the Confederates and the national capital. On 1 July, the 20th Maine received word to press on to Gettysburg. The Union Army had engaged the Confederates there, and Union commanders were hurrying all available forces to the hills south of the little town. The 20th Maine arrived at Gettysburg near midday on 2 July, after marching more than 100 miles in 5 days. They had only 2 hours' sleep and no hot food during the past 24 hours. The regiment was preparing to go into a defensive position as part of the brigade when a staff officer rode up and began gesturing towards a little hill at the extreme southern end of the Union line. The hill, Little Round Top, dominated the Union position and, at that moment, was unoccupied. If the Confederates placed artillery on it, they could force the entire Union army to withdraw. The hill had been left unprotected by a series of mistakes, wrong assumptions, the failure to communicate clearly, and the failure to check, and the situation was critical. Realizing the danger, Colonel Vincent ordered his brigade to occupy Little Round Top. He positioned the 20th Maine, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Joshua L. Chamberlain, on his brigade's left flank, the extreme left of the Union line. Colonel Vincent ordered Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain to hold at all hazards. On Little Round Top, Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain told his company commanders the purpose and importance of their mission. He ordered the right flank company to tie in with the 83rd Pennsylvania and the left flank company to anchor on a large boulder. His thoughts turned to the left flank. There was nothing there except a small hollow and the rising slope of Big Round Top. The 20th Maine was literally at the end of the line. Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain then showed a skill common to good tactical leaders. He imagined threats to his unit, did what he could to guard against them, and considered what he could do to meet other possible threats. Since his left flank was open, Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain sent B Company, commanded by Captain Walter G. Morrill, off to guard it and act as the necessities of the battle required. The captain positioned his men behind a stone wall that would face the flank of any Confederate advance. There, 14 soldiers from the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters who had been separated from their unit joined them. The 20th Maine had been in position only a few minutes when the soldiers of the 15th and 47th Alabama attacked. The Confederates also had marched all night and were tired and thirsty. Even so, they attacked ferociously. The Maine men held their ground, but then one of Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain's officers reported seeing a large body of Confederate soldiers moving laterally behind the attacking force. Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain climbed on a rock, exposing himself to enemy fire, and saw a Confederate unit moving around his exposed left flank. If they outflanked him, his unit would be pushed off its position and destroyed. He would have failed his mission. Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain had to think fast. The tactical manuals he so diligently studied called for a maneuver that would not work on this terrain. He had to create a new maneuver, one that his soldiers could clearly understand and execute now. The 20th Maine was in a defensive line, 2 ranks deep. It was threatened by an attack around its left flank. So the colonel ordered his company commanders to stretch the line to the left and bend it back to form an angle, concealing the maneuver by keeping up a steady rate of fire. Now Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain's thin line was only 1 rank deep. His units, covering twice their normal frontage, were bent back into an L shape. Minutes after repositioning his force, the Confederate infantry, moving up to what they thought was an open flank, were thrown back by the redeployed left wing of the 20th Maine. Surprised and angry, they nonetheless attacked again. The Maine men rallied and held their ground. The Confederates regrouped and attacked. The Alabamians drove the Maine men from their positions 5 times. 5 times they fought their way back again. At some places, the muzzles of the opposing guns almost touched. Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain saw that he could not stay where he was and could not withdraw, so he decided to counterattack. His men would have the advantage of attacking down the steep hill, he reasoned, and the Confederates would not be expecting it. Clearly, he was risking his entire unit, but the fate of the Union Army depended on his men. The decision left Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain with another problem. There was nothing in his tactics book about how to get his unit from its L-shaped position into a line of advance. Under tremendous fire and in the midst of battle, Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain again called his commanders together. He explained that the regiment's left wing would swing around like a barn door on a hinge until it was even with the right wing. Then the entire regiment, bayonets fixed, would charge downhill, staying anchored to the 83rd Pennsylvania on its right. The explanation was clear and the situation clearly desperate. When Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain gave the order, Lieutenant Holman Melcher of F Company leaped forward and led the left wing downhill toward the surprised Confederates. Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain had positioned himself at the center of the L. When the left wing was abreast of the right wing, he jumped off the rock and led the right wing down the hill. The entire regiment was now charging on line, swinging like a great barn door, just as its commander intended. The Alabama soldiers, stunned at the sight of the charging Union troops, fell back on the positions behind them. There, the 20th Maine's charge might have failed if not for a surprise resulting from Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain's foresight. Just then, Captain Morrill's B Company and the sharpshooters opened fire on the Confederate flank and rear. The exhausted and shattered Alabama regiments thought they were surrounded. They broke and ran, not realizing that one more attack would have carried the hill. The slopes of Little Round Top were littered with bodies. Saplings halfway up the hill had been sawed in half by weapons fire. A third of the 20th Maine had fallen. Nonetheless, the farmers, woodsmen, and fishermen from Maine, under the command of a brave and creative leader who had anticipated enemy actions, improvised under fire, and applied disciplined initiative in the heat of the battle, had fought through to victory. This short story of Colonel Chamberlain's exploits sums up what many new commanders will face when in command, the uncertain and the unknown. Command relationships. The squadron's primary mission needs to be a commander's number one priority, since many factors affect a unit's ability to perform its mission effectively. Regarding unit effectiveness, the relationships your squadron and you have with the many other squadrons in the wing play an important dynamic in ensuring your unit succeeds in its mission. Few units can perform their mission in isolation. Cooperation among squadrons is essential to success in the Air Force. Further, one of the commander's key actions is to oversee interactions with activities outside the unit, allowing squadron members the freedom to accomplish the mission internally. A sharp commander acts as a combination giant shield and absorbent sponge, reflecting, absorbing, and filtering external inputs to the squadron and enabling everyone else to go about their business. Your fellow squadron commanders. Once you've been able to meet most, if not all, of your squadron members, it's essential that you get out to introduce yourself to those group and wing officers who will play an important part in your command. Your fellow squadron commanders. One of the first things that happens after you take the guidance of command is that your peer group changes dramatically. Simply put, you're no longer one of the gang. Group commanders should not be left out either. The time you likely are first introduced to these wing leaders will occur at the post-change of command reception. Although this occurs in a social setting, it's important to follow this short introduction with a more formal one. Within days of your taking command, not weeks, set up a courtesy call with each of their offices. If you have the option, take a squadron coin, hat, or patch as a welcoming gesture. They'll remember you for it. Leave a business card if you have one. Ask them what you and your squadron can do for them. Flesh out what their specific needs are, how well or not things have gone in the past, and exchange ideas so your squadrons can be of mutual benefit to the overall team goal of the group and wing. One of the most important things I did, just after assuming my commands, was to get out and make appointments with my fellow squadron commanders as a way of introduction, said Lieutenant Colonel Rollins Hickman. It didn't have to be a long meeting, but it was a great opportunity to sit down, one-on-one, in their offices and talk about where we were going together toward helping make the group and wing better accomplish its mission. I asked them what it is I and my squadron could do to help their squadron's individual mission. I took the time to let them know where I, too, thought their squadron could help my mission get accomplished, he added. Colonel Hickman's excellent suggestion undoubtedly will pay big dividends down the road. As often is the case, soon after taking the guidon, you'll be swept up in the daily grind and won't have the chance to talk with your fellow commanders outside of wing staff meetings, enlisted graduations, and other formal functions. Nurture them as your allies and advocates early. If you have a cadre of trusted confidants with whom you share personal, squadron, and sensitive issues, make sure you include a fellow squadron commander or two, particularly one who's been in command past the honeymoon or first quarter period. If you've chosen wisely, they will undoubtedly offer you insights that you may have missed and will often shed a different light on the situation. As the new commander, you rarely will enter a situation where each unit commander totally agrees on every issue. Rather, there likely will be a lot of give and take on subjects that affect all squadrons. Also, natural rivalries are present in most wings. These rivalries may result from multiple units performing the same or similar missions, or squadrons with slightly different missions using the same equipment, or competing for the same space or units borrowing or using personnel from other units. These rivalries or competitions can be healthy for the wing if the squadron commanders can maintain their focus on how to improve mission accomplishment. Be careful, though, for focusing on these rivalries can get ugly if the involved commanders start taking things personally and focus their squadron on doing better while simultaneously making the other units look bad. This accomplishes nothing. All squadrons should enjoy some healthy rivalry, but be careful that it doesn't go too far and create professional walls between units. Although this tactic may appear to have a short-term positive influence on you and your squadron, history is full of examples where this has failed miserably. Teamwork really does work, and the team is not restricted to your unit. All of the wing's elements work as a team. The basic organization of some wings creates natural barriers to smooth squadron relationships totally. Two different commanders explained how one of their wing's squadrons trained personnel for three operational squadrons. The wing's dynamics led to a sometimes adversarial relationship between the operational units and the training unit. The commanders eventually solved their squadron's long-existing differences, but not without a good deal of compromise on each side. The main lesson was that the commanders were smart enough to place the wing's mission above squadron-only interests. The key elements involved here were the squadron commanders themselves. They decided to work together first, then to allow their units to follow suit. What are some of the things a peer group of squadron commanders can do to build a better team relationship? Here are a few examples. 1. Some wing commanders have been noted to take care of this issue directly by holding monthly wing squadron commander luncheons. If such a program does not yet exist at your wing, take the lead and organize one. However, while this facilitated that particular relationship, it did not permit the squadron commanders to hash it out with each other, as they sometimes needed periodic meetings of squadron commanders to discuss current issues, and topics are great facilitators of cross-feed information. As an option, get together for breakfast at the dining facility once a month or so without the wing group commander. 2. More informal get-togethers work well also, and you don't have to have every other commander present to get some business done. Get together to jog together once a week, or arrange to meet at the club every now and then to share ideas and gripes. 3. One commander explained to me how he and his fellow squadron commanders got together once a quarter to discuss personnel moves within the wing. If they all concurred on some proposed replacements, they would actively approach their bosses with their unified suggestions. 4. Socialize together. 2 or 3 times a year, the squadron commanders and their spouses might go out as a group, with nobody else going along. The commander who suggested it to me said it was pleasant going to a party where everyone there was on the same level, no one above or below you. Proverb for leadership. A true leader is not satisfied with only knowing how to do what will get the organization through today. You must also be concerned about what it will need tomorrow. True leaders seek out opportunities. They're always looking for ways to increase their professional knowledge and skills. Your boss. As with their peer group, most commanders interviewed enjoyed a good relationship with their bosses. In most cases, squadron commanders' bosses had themselves commanded squadrons before and understood many of the inherent challenges. They've been in your shoes. Also, bosses naturally want to see their commanders succeed. To a degree, their own success depends on their subordinate unit's successful performance. Indeed, most group commanders will admit that they exist to facilitate optimum squadron operations. Squadron commanders are truly the key leaders. Many bosses or supervisors of squadron commanders will let the commander run the outfit as he or she sees fit. This type of situation is great. However, I've heard of a few bosses who tended to micromanage squadrons. If you get one like this, you may have to walk a tightrope to keep firm control. The micromanagers tend to micromanage only small segments of a squadron's operations, those areas they feel most comfortable with. The best advice I can offer here is to ascertain quickly what aspects of your unit are likely to get a lot of attention. Become a subject matter expert in these hot areas, and do your best to shield your people in any hot area from undue scrutiny. A number of squadron commanders mentioned that their immediate boss, usually a group commander, was not co-located on their base. Their geographical separation added another dimension to the relationship between the squadron and group commander. This can sometimes be a good thing or a bad thing if it is not handled properly. Lieutenant Colonel James Weimer commanded the 763rd Expeditionary Airlift Squadron, C-130, at Seeb North Air Base, Muscat, Oman. As head of an expeditionary unit supporting operations in Southwest Asia, the commander had the added burden of commanding his squadron with his group commander located hundreds of miles away at Prince Sultan Air Base, Saudi Arabia. My boss and I talked every week at a certain, predetermined time. It was essentially a weekly staff meeting with me, and since we scheduled it well in advance, it allowed us to clear our schedules accordingly. Of course, if I needed his ear in between those times, I called him whenever I needed him. I never felt at a loss to talk to my boss, observed Colonel Weimer. Finally, a new squadron commander will quickly realize that he serves more than one boss. The immediate supervisor is likely to be some kind of group commander. You also may have responsibilities to a major command or an Air Force-level directorate. However, the wing commander is also a boss, the big boss. Some wing commanders use different styles to run the show. Some will deal or interface solely with their group commanders and deputies. Others will deal mostly with the deputies and some squadron commanders. And some others frequently will work directly with the squadron commanders. A squadron commander's job here is to find out how the game is being played in the wing and adjust to the new style. Be smart. If you back brief your immediate supervisor when necessary, you should stay out of trouble. Also, it might be wise to get a handle on the relationship between your immediate boss and the wing commander. If they have complementary personalities and share the same vision, things are relatively easy. If they don't, you may experience some problems. Be prepared. Building unit cohesion and morale. Morale makes up 3/4 of the game. The relative balance of manpower accounts for only the remaining quarter. Napoleon. Building unit cohesion and morale may be one of your most challenging tasks. There is always a variety of things going on to drag down unit cohesion and morale, whether intentional or not. Even if you were lucky enough to inherit a squadron whose morale already was high, you can be assured it was so because your predecessor made it a top priority. And keeping it high must be one of your top priorities as well. Lieutenant Colonel Eileen Isola offered, I had to tackle a unit identity problem right off the bat. I made sure that every airman in the command knew what their purpose was in the squadron, what the unit mission was, and how very important their contribution was to making our mission a success. Ensuring that every member of your squadron fully understands and embraces the mission of your unit is a cornerstone of unit cohesion. Every member must feel a purpose for his or her service. It's imperative that everyone is singing from the same sheet of music, and the commander is the orchestra's maestro. Added Lieutenant Colonel Michael Prues, who commanded the 343rd Reconnaissance Squadron, RC-135, Offutt Air Force Base, Nebraska, build an identity for your organization. An identity fosters improved esprit de corps. I have seen enhanced mission performance in an organization that held simple but effective farewell luncheons and handed out plaques. These luncheons reminded everyone of the unit's collective mission and desire to recognize people that continued to produce the unit's success. There are two significant reasons that building and maintaining high unit cohesion and morale are so difficult. There isn't a single checklist to make them happen, and there are so many variables to touch upon that it necessarily takes up a good portion of your time. What's good for the goose may not be good for the gander, and what one airman likes, another may not like at all. This is not a case where you can't be all things to all people. It's broader than that. Above all, what my experiences have shown, and those corroborated by other squadron commanders have proven, is this. Lead by example. You might be saying, lead by example? I've heard that statement so many times it's lost its significance. Maybe so, but I hope not. Assimilating all the many pieces of advice offered in this work is the true challenge for the new squadron commander. This is the most important time to walk the walk and talk the talk. Referring to the adage of the glass house, your troops are constantly watching you. If you appear to be having fun, they'll have little reason not to have fun as well. If you appear to be taking the unit's mission seriously, they will too. If you appear to work hard and play hard, they'll follow your lead in trail. One thing I instituted to build unit cohesion that worked well for me early in my command that probably doesn't come to many people's minds was to have an occasional open ranks inspection, said Lieutenant Colonel Don Flowers, who commanded the 66th Logistics Squadron, Hanscom Air Force Base, Massachusetts. I know it doesn't sound like a crowd pleaser, and it wasn't at first, but it kept everyone in line and reminded them that they were in the Air Force. Everyone was treated equally and fairly, and it stopped complacency. The standards were high. Those who were exceptional were given letters of excellence and 24-hour passes as appropriate. Morale quickly increased, he added. Major J. Carroll had an interesting idea that helped spark his unit's morale. For such a large unit, and one that needed constant care and feeding, he came up with a good morale-boosting idea for his security forces squadron. I knew I had some of the Air Force's sharpest people working for me and the wing, yet they didn't look that way. We had elite, hand-picked airmen working the gates, but didn't have the proper uniforms for them. So I asked my boss for additional funds for special uniforms and equipment for our elite gate guards. They felt proud and distinguished. It paid huge dividends. The many successes of former squadron commanders who have offered advice will be captured in this section, as well as in specific portions of Chapter 3 under People. Proverb for Command. To motivate your people, give them missions that challenge them. Give them as much responsibility as they can handle, then let them do the work without looking over their shoulders and nagging them. When they succeed, praise them. When they fall short, give them credit for what they have done and counsel or coach them on how to do better next time. People who are trained this way will accomplish the mission even when no one is watching. They will work harder than they thought they could, and when their leader notices and gives them credit, they will be ready to take on even more next time. Proverb for Leadership. There are no cookie-cutter solutions to leadership challenges, and there are no shortcuts to success. However, the tools are available to every leader. It is up to you to master and use them. On-duty cohesion and morale. Colonel Mark Brown had a significant challenge of rebuilding his squadron into a cohesive team of recruiters. He commanded more than 100 personnel who were spread over nearly 500 square miles in the rural areas of Louisiana, Arkansas, and Mississippi. He went back to the basics of leadership. He clearly understood where the squadron needed to be with respect to unit cohesion and morale, and he successfully articulated his vision to the entire squadron of where he wanted the squadron to end up in 1 year. He brought his senior non-commissioned officer corps on board, and with their buy-in, he set out to travel among his command to meet each member and discuss his vision. This is something that I quickly noticed was missing. The recruiters were so engrossed in meeting their specific recruiting goals that they lost sight of the big picture. I thought it was my responsibility to get them back on track. The morale of your squadron's personnel comes from three sources: a feeling that they have an important job to do, a feeling that they are trained to do it well, and the feeling that their great work is appreciated and recognized. Of course, it is the commander who inculcates these ideals. Lieutenant Colonel George Eichelberger inherited a healthy squadron when he took command of the 390th Intelligence Squadron, Kadena Air Base, Japan. He recognized that although morale seemed to be at a pretty high level, it wouldn't stay that way long without keeping the flame lit. Keeping morale up wasn't that difficult. It took some effort on my part to act as the squadron cheerleader all the time, and it helped when I kept reminding each of my squadron members how important they were to the mission of the squadron. Even though we didn't have a 9-to-5 mentality, it was tough sometimes to keep everyone focused, and I felt it was my responsibility to set and maintain the vision. Lieutenant Colonel Donald Flowers had an interesting approach to maintaining unit cohesion. He recalled, "While up in Massachusetts, one of our airmen suggested we help keep the areas outside the base clean by picking up trash every quarter or so. I thought it was a great idea that was supported by the whole squadron. So we signed up with the state as part of the Adopt a Highway program. It was great." Finally, the leader must constantly walk the fine line between focusing on the immediate task and focusing on group cohesion. The work of strategic decision-making is tedious, difficult, and tension-provoking. Without tension, the work will not proceed. With too much tension, the group will focus on the tension itself rather than on the work to be done. One of the leader's many jobs is to maintain this delicate balance, to jointly optimize progress and group health. Off-duty cohesion and morale. Off-duty time is also extremely important to you and your personnel, whether it's an informal gathering after work, a squadron intramural sporting event, or a baby shower. Therefore, it's something that will require your attention. Once again, many commanders handled this situation completely different from others, citing their base location as the most common driving factor. Those who commanded at remote or rural locations, i.e. Osan Air Base, Korea, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, or Lackland Air Force Base, Texas, enjoyed closer squadron relations both on and off duty. Because there simply wasn't a great deal of activities available in the local community, it necessarily forced them to socialize as a group outside the unit. Every commander interviewed who commanded a squadron in one of these areas remarked how much he or she enjoyed this particular aspect of their tenure in command. Conversely, those who have commanded in urban areas, i.e. Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada, Hickam Air Force Base, Hawaii, or Stuttgart Air Base, Germany, found that their unit's personnel often did not want to pursue an active squadron-centered social life outside the squadron. There were plenty of activities to be found within the local community. These commanders remarked that this, too, was not a problem for them. Both examples highlight the fact that building unit cohesion and morale off-duty is not absolutely necessary, but it is an option for the commander if he or she sees the need. Bottom line, feel the pulse of the squadron and don't force it. Formal inspections. If you don't have enough responsibilities on your plate by now, the Air Force is always willing to add a few more. If you are commanding an Air Force squadron, the chances are high that you'll have at least one formal inspection, like a Unit Compliance Inspection, UCI, Operational Readiness Inspection, ORI, or Standardization and Evaluation Visit. This is not only an important evaluation of your squadron, it's a direct evaluation of you and your leadership. Few, if any, inspections are truly no-notice evaluations, so you should have ample time to prepare your squadron accordingly. Said Lieutenant Colonel Robert Summonsby, Jr., "Formal inspections are the only chance you get outside combat to prove how good you are." Before the inspection, what have others done in this situation? The first place to start is with the past inspection results. What areas did the inspectors evaluate? How well did your squadron do during the last inspection? How long has it been since the last formal visit? You may have to start your planning from scratch, particularly if your unit has had a heavy turnover of personnel. Do you know what agency is scheduled to give the inspection? You probably do. Call the functional managers of the inspection team and open a dialogue with them. They'll likely give you a good vector as to what they're going to be looking at during their visit, and this too will help you build a plan for your squadron. How far in advance you begin your planning and preparation will be completely up to you, given the circumstances and scope of the visit. You undoubtedly will have something already on your plate, given the operations tempo and the personnel tempo of your unit, so prioritizing will be especially important. Although you do not operate in a vacuum, it is definitely your responsibility to chart the course for your squadron. Your planning must begin first, and when you have an idea of how you want to attack the subject, write it down on paper and then put it away for a week or so. Revisit the plan after you've had some time to think of your strategy, and then do the next most important thing. Put the right person in charge of executing your vision. Like anything else, having the right person in the right job usually ends with great success. For their success and yours, do your very best to clear as many extraneous tasks off their plate as possible to give them the time they need to prepare adequately. Give them the tools and resources necessary to do their job well. Perhaps most importantly, keeping them, as well as yourself, motivated will help keep you all focused and on track. Prepping too far in advance can be as much a problem as prepping too late. The tried and tested law of burnout may apply. Be careful not to peak too early. Former commanders tell me that the type of inspection and the inspection philosophy of the major command are two important factors to consider when preparing a unit. One of the easiest ways to prepare for an inspection is simply to read the mail, beginning with the past squadron and wing inspection reports. Any problem areas identified in the past definitely will be closely scrutinized again. Your squadron also should receive the results of other wings' inspections by the same inspection team that is going to visit you. Pay attention to what these reports say, and you will have a blueprint of what the inspection team is currently emphasizing. Most commanders stress the need for a solid self-inspection program. One officer told me that he actively used a year-round program to constantly fine-tune his unit's mission and programs. Major inspections then normally fell in line with existing self-inspection efforts, and erratic or extraordinary preparation efforts were not necessary. Many commanders used this type of approach and involved all unit personnel, emphasizing that the squadron would succeed or fail together. Other commanders related that routine, year-round self-inspection programs are better in theory than in practice. They would appoint a small team of experienced supervisors to specifically run through the entire squadron's self-inspection program a couple of months before the inspection to identify potential problem areas. Timing is crucial. Self-inspections shouldn't wait until the last minute. They necessitate solid documentation and, above all else, demand an honest, close look at squadron performance. During the inspection, clearly your primary concern here is to remain focused. Keep focused on the task at hand, and do your best to ensure everyone else keeps the same focus. The specific actions you take in leading and guiding your squadron to success will largely depend on what type of inspection you are receiving. Once the inspection team arrives, you and others probably will be relieved to get the inspection underway and finished. After their departure, tuck your winning results away for the next lucky commander who gets the next chance to excel. As always, your leadership will play a big part in your squadron's success during an inspection, and most former commanders will tell you to take the lead early and literally lead the way. A former flying squadron commander related that he thought it was absolutely necessary to be the one to take the first in-flight evaluation on the toughest mission. When you step back and think about this tactic, it makes good sense for several reasons. First, his squadron personnel will respect the commander's close involvement in the inspection by putting himself in the line of fire first. Lead by example. Second, he considered it would get his unit off on the right track because he thought it critical to be the best in the weapon system and, as such, would set the stage for the following evaluations. And finally, he knew that any inspection team would more closely investigate a squadron whose commander tried to duck the schedule during a formal inspection. Like any inspection, whether it's a normal squadron visit from the wing commander, if that can be called normal, or a full-blown major command, MAGCOM, inspection, you'll want to make sure the red carpet is put out. Continue to keep your unit clean and free of debris, a dirty and unkempt squadron sends a poor message. Keep enough moles around, in addition to yourself, to make sure that any minor infraction uncovered by the team on one day doesn't happen the next. Get the word out to your troops. The inspectors will be impressed and notice that you've made attempts to correct infractions on the spot and prevent any repeats. If you're fortunate enough to have a sister squadron of like mission or function that may be getting inspected before your unit does, you should capitalize on being a great fellow squadron commander. Without crossing any ethical boundaries, keep a close eye on the progress of their inspection and make changes in your unit as necessary. Four general areas of advice came from the group interviewed most often. They were as follows. 1. Be smart and put your best foot forward. 2. Be positive, honest, and above board. 3. Put your personal expertise and leadership to work. 4. Stay informed during the inspection. Some inspection teams will want or need specific information either before they arrive or very shortly after they get to your base. Be smart and provide them everything they want when they want it. If there are certain portions of this information you are particularly proud of and want to emphasize, make sure you highlight it. One squadron commander described a new squadron program that had just been completed before the team's arrival. It was the first such program in command, and it dealt directly with the unit's mission. He went out of his way to emphasize this new program, and the inspection team was clearly impressed. In fact, the team spent so much time looking at his program in an effort to benchmark it command-wide that they didn't have as much time left to scrutinize some other programs that may not have been as good. And if you weren't the principal architect of that particular award-winning program, make sure the inspector knows the names of those who were to give them the recognition they deserve. Another facet of being smart concerns your scheduling plans during the inspection. The inspection team will be looking to make sure you haven't allowed your weakest team members to take leave during the inspection, and they may ask to see a unit personnel roster to verify those personnel who were not present due to a temporary duty tasking. While you shouldn't encourage your weakest folks to take leave during formal inspections, and in many cases you won't have complete control of short-notice temporary duty taskings, you also shouldn't put your newest and most inexperienced people on the toughest shifts or during known periods of difficult inspections. You wouldn't schedule that way in a war if you could avoid it, so don't do it here either. A balanced schedule of your unit's personnel, ensuring the most experienced are teamed with the least experienced, works well in most situations. If the Inspector General or any other type of inspection team finds some obvious problems during the inspection, don't spend a lot of time, if any, trying to talk your way out of it unless the team is actually wrong and their call will affect other portions of your unit's inspection. For example, if an inspector finds some minor administrative discrepancies with your squadron's leave program, acknowledge the errors, ask for advice on how to improve the program, and move on. Get over it. Don't let a few minor things snowball into the major portion of the inspection. Most commanders who have been through an inspection will agree that being honest and upfront was the best advice to follow. Generally speaking, the inspectors themselves are experts in the areas they are looking hard at and won't be fooled easily. You should cut your losses by acknowledging a problem area, fix it as quickly as possible, and press on to more important matters at hand. After the inspection, although you may be relieved to see the inspection completed, there's still a bit of work to do before you get to celebrate. For example, you should document every finding you can in some type of after-action report. This serves many purposes, not the least of which is to fix any problems unearthed by the inspection team. There's generally no better time than the present in these situations to mend any broken fences. Although your unit personnel may be tired and not happy about it, fixing these problem areas while the griddle's hot is always better than trying to do it later. Following this advice means events will be fresh on yours and their minds, and you'll likely have all the primary players in place to get it done more quickly and efficiently. A good technique is to give your troops a day of rest to catch their breath and allow them to collect their thoughts. Have your senior leadership hold a series of meetings to gather the pertinent data from each of your squadron's individual shops or flights. Then host a single meeting with just the key players where you can lead the debrief for the entire unit. This type of internal squadron cross-feed enables unit personnel to see the bigger picture and allows everyone to get on the same page to benefit from the team's observations. Inspectors will often pass on some valuable information or techniques used by other MAGCOM units that you can pass on to the entire squadron when appropriate to improve the unit's overall mission capability. Don't miss this golden opportunity. Another good reason to hold an after-action review is to capture those lessons learned for future inspections. This was considered vital by many squadron commanders. One officer related that he kept a detailed log of events as he saw them, included them with the informal after-action review notes, and filed them away for the next commander. The golden rule seems always to work. I took advantage of holding these same review meetings after a particularly successful ORI. In addition to the above-mentioned advantages, I found my notes to be extremely useful during the rest of the year when I had to write and edit both officer and enlisted performance reports. You may not have the luxury of having a unit historian of any type, so it's up to you to take care of the troops by keeping track of your past successes. I had to return several performance reports for a rewrite because those who wrote them failed to include such pertinent information. These notes also will come in handy if you are fortunate enough to have your squadron submitted for any United States Air Force MAGCOM or wing-level annual awards. Doing a little bit of work now will pay big dividends later. Now it's time to party. Assuming the inspection went well, it is very appropriate to have some type of social gathering to thank those who participated and to recognize those who excelled. This could be something as simple as a backyard burger burn or a full-blown party at your squadron or club. Having some type of celebration, regardless of the inspection's outcome, brings closure to the hard work your unit's members and their families have put in over the last several months. It provides a healthy breather before getting back to work on the next task. Recall again the leadership lessons of Colonel Chamberlain's victory at Little Round Top. He focused on the mission and objective, established a strategy based on known information, maintained the fluidity to adapt to a rapidly changing battlefield, and above all, led his troops with confidence even in the face of the many unknowns. There were no black and white checklists to leadership in his situation, and I emphasize the same for you, the new squadron commander. But there were distinct guiding principles for mission accomplishment, and those will buttress your command just as they did Chamberlain's.